state of New York prohibited the sale of slaves within its limits, which was an indirect method of prohibiting the importation of blacks. Thenceforth, the number of Negroes could only increase according to the ratio of the natural increase of population. But 8 years later, a more decisive measure was taken. It was enacted that all children born of slave parents after July 4, 1799, should be free. No increase could then take place, and although slaves still existed, slavery might be said to be abolished. From the time at which a northern state prohibited the importation of slaves, no slaves were brought from the South to be sold in its markets. On the other hand, as the sale of slaves was forbidden in that state, an owner was no longer able to get rid of his slave, who thus became a burdensome possession, otherwise than by transporting him to the South. But when a northern state declared that the son of the slave should be born free, the slave lost a portion of his market value, since his posterity was no longer included in the bargain, and the owner had then a strong interest in transporting him to the South. Thus, the same law prevents the slaves of the South from coming to the northern states and drives those of the North to the South. The want of free hands is felt in a state in proportion as the number of slaves decreases, but in proportion as labor is performed by free hands, slave labor becomes less productive, and the slave is then a useless or onerous possession, whom it is important to export to those southern states where the same competition is not to be feared. Thus, the abolition of slavery does not set the slave free, but it merely transfers him from one master to another, and from the North to the South. The emancipated Negroes and those born after the abolition of slavery do not indeed migrate from the North to the South, but their situation with regard to the Europeans is not unlike that of the Aborigines of America. They remain half-civilized, and deprived of their rights in the midst of a population which is far superior to them in wealth and in knowledge, where they are exposed to the tyranny of the laws and the intolerance of the people. Author's note: the states in which slavery is abolished usually do what they can to render their territory disagreeable to the Negroes as a place of residence. And as a kind of emulation exists between the different states in this respect, the unhappy blacks can only choose the least of the evils which beset them. On some accounts, they are still more to be pitied than the Indians, since they are haunted by the reminiscence of slavery, and they cannot claim possession of a single portion of the soil. Many of them perish miserably, and the rest congregate in the great towns where they perform the meanest offices and lead a wretched and precarious existence. Author's note: there is a very great difference between the mortality of the blacks and of the whites in the states in which slavery is abolished. From 1820 to 1831, only 1 out of 42 individuals of the white population died in Philadelphia, but 1 Negro out of 21 individuals of the black population died in the same space of time. The mortality is by no means so great amongst the Negroes, who are still slaves. But even if the number of Negroes continued to increase as rapidly as when they were still in a state of slavery, as the number of whites augments with twofold rapidity since the abolition of slavery, the blacks would soon be, as it were, lost in the midst of a strange population. A district which is cultivated by slaves is in general more scantily peopled than a district cultivated by free labor. Moreover, America is still a new country, and a state is therefore not half-peopled at the time when it abolishes slavery. No sooner is an end put to slavery than the want of free labor is felt, and a crowd of enterprising adventurers immediately arrive from all parts of the country, who hasten to profit by the fresh resources which are then opened to industry. The soil is soon divided amongst them, and a family of white settlers takes possession of each tract of country, beside which European emigration is exclusively directed to the free states. For what would be the fate of a poor immigrant who crosses the Atlantic in search of ease and happiness if he were to land in a country where labor is stigmatized as degrading? Thus the white population grows by its natural increase and at the same time by the immense influx of emigrants, whilst the black population receives no emigrants and is upon its decline. The proportion which existed between the two races is soon inverted. The Negroes constitute a scanty remnant, a poor tribe of vagrants, which is lost in the midst of an immense people in full possession of the land. And the presence of the blacks is only marked by the injustice and the hardships of which they are the unhappy victims. In several of the western states, the Negro race never made its appearance, and in all the northern states, it is rapidly declining. Thus, the great question of its future condition is confined within a narrow circle, where it becomes less formidable, though not more easy of solution. The more we descend towards the south, the more difficult does it become to abolish slavery with advantage, and this arises from several physical causes which it is important to point out. The first of these causes is the climate. It is well known that in proportion as Europeans approach the tropics, they suffer more from labor. Many of the Americans even assert that within a certain latitude, the exertions which a Negro can make without danger are fatal to them. But I do not think that this opinion, which is so favorable to the indolence of the inhabitants of southern regions, is confirmed by experience. The southern parts of the Union are not hotter than the south of Italy and of Spain, and it may be asked why the Europeans cannot work as well there as in the two latter countries. Author's note: these states are nearer to the equator than Italy and Spain, but the temperature of the continent of America is very much lower than that of Europe. The Spanish government formerly caused a certain number of peasants from the Azores to be transported into a district of Louisiana called the Atacapa by way of experiment. These settlers still cultivate the soil without the assistance of slaves, but their industry is so languid as scarcely to supply their most necessary wants. If slavery has been abolished in Italy and in Spain without causing the destruction of the masters, why should not the same thing take place in the Union? I cannot believe that nature has prohibited the Europeans in Georgia and the Floridas under pain of death from raising the means of subsistence from the soil, but their labor would unquestionably be more irksome and less productive to them than to the inhabitants of New England. As the free workman thus loses a portion of his superiority over the slave in the southern states, there are fewer inducements to abolish slavery. All the plants of Europe grow in the northern parts of the Union. The South has special productions of its own. It has been observed that slave labor is a very expensive method of cultivating corn. The farmer of corn land in a country where slavery is unknown habitually retains a small number of laborers in his service, and at seed time and harvest, he hires several additional hands who only live at his cost for a short period. But the agriculturalist in a slave state is obliged to keep a large number of slaves the whole year round in order to sow his fields and to gather in his crops, although their services are only required for a few weeks. But slaves are unable to wait till they are hired, and to subsist by their own labor in the meantime like free laborers. In order to have their services, they must be bought. Slavery, independently of its general disadvantages, is therefore still more inapplicable to countries in which corn is cultivated than to those which produce crops of a different kind. The cultivation of tobacco, of cotton, and especially of sugarcane, demands, on the other hand, unremitting attention, and women and children are employed in it, whose services are of but little use in the cultivation of wheat. Thus, slavery is naturally more fitted to the countries from which these productions are derived. Tobacco, cotton, and the sugar cane are exclusively grown in the South, and they form one of the principal sources of the wealth of those states. If slavery were abolished, the inhabitants of the South would be constrained to adopt one of two alternatives. They must either change their system of cultivation, and then they would come into competition with the more active and more experienced inhabitants of the North, or, if they continued to cultivate the same produce without slave labor, they would have to support the competition of the other states of the South, which might still retain their slaves. Thus, peculiar reasons for maintaining slavery exist in the South which do not operate in the North. But there is yet another motive which is more cogent than all the others. The South might indeed, rigorously speaking, abolish slavery, but how should it rid its territory of the black population? Slaves and slavery are driven from the North by the same law, but this twofold result cannot be hoped for in the South. The arguments, which I have adduced to show that slavery is more natural and more advantageous in the South than in the North, sufficiently proved that the number of slaves must be far greater in the former districts. It was to the southern settlements that the first Africans were brought, and it is there that the greatest number of them have always been imported. As we advance towards the south, the prejudice which sanctions idleness increases in power. In the states nearest to the tropics, there is not a single white laborer. The Negroes are constantly much more numerous in the south than in the north. And, as I have already observed, this disproportion increases daily, since the Negroes are transferred to one part of the Union as soon as slavery is abolished in the other. Thus the black population augments in the South, not only by its natural fecundity, but by the compulsory emigration of the Negroes from the North. And the African race has causes of increase in the South very analogous to those which so powerfully accelerate the growth of the European race in the North. In the state of Maine, there is one Negro in 300 inhabitants. In Massachusetts, one in 100. In New York, two in 100. In Pennsylvania, three in the same number. In Maryland, 34. In Virginia, 42. And lastly, in South Carolina, 55%. Such was the proportion of the black population to the whites in the year 1830. But this proportion is perpetually changing, as it constantly decreases in the North and augments in the South. Author's note: we find it asserted in an American work entitled Letters on the Colonization Society by Mr. Carey, 1833, that for the last 40 years the black race has increased more rapidly than the white race in the state of South Carolina, and that if we take the average population of the five states of the South into which slaves were first introduced, namely Maryland, Virginia, South Carolina, North Carolina, and Georgia, we shall find that from 1790 to 1830, the whites have augmented in the proportion of 80 to 100, and the blacks in that of 112 to 100. In the United States in 1830, the population of the two races stood as follows. States where slavery is abolished, 6,565,334 whites, 120,520 blacks. Slave states, 3,960,814 whites, 2,208,102 blacks. It is evident that the most southern states of the Union cannot abolish slavery without incurring very great dangers, which the North had no reason to apprehend when it emancipated its black population. We have already shown the system by which the northern states secured the transition from slavery to freedom, by keeping the present generation in chains and setting their descendants free. By this means, the Negroes are gradually introduced into society, and whilst the men who might abuse their freedom are kept in a state of servitude, those who are emancipated may learn the art of being free before they become their own masters. But it would be difficult to apply this method in the South. To declare that all the Negroes born after a certain period shall be free is to introduce the principle and the notion of liberty into the heart of slavery. The blacks, whom the law thus maintains in a state of slavery from which their children are delivered, are astonished at so unequal a fate, and their astonishment is only the prelude to their impatience and irritation. Thenceforward, slavery loses in their eyes that kind of moral power which it derived from time and habit. It is reduced to a mere palpable abuse of force. The northern states had nothing to fear from the contrast, because in them the blacks were few in number, and the white population was very considerable. But if this faint dawn of freedom were to show 2 million of men their true position, the oppressors would have reason to tremble. After having enfranchised the children of their slaves, the Europeans of the southern states would very shortly be obliged to extend the same benefit to the whole black population. In the north, as I have already remarked, a twofold migration ensues upon the abolition of slavery, or even precedes that event when circumstances have rendered it probable. The slaves quit the country to be transported southwards, and the whites of the northern states, as well as the emigrants from Europe, hasten to fill up their place. But these two causes cannot operate in the same manner in the southern states. On the one hand, the mass of slaves is too great for any expectation of their ever being removed from the country to be entertained. And on the other hand, the Europeans and Anglo-Americans of the north are afraid to come to inhabit a country in which labor has not yet been reinstated in its rightful honors. Besides, the very justly look upon the states in which the proportion of the Negroes equals or exceeds that of the whites as exposed to very great dangers, and they refrain from turning their activity in that direction. Thus the inhabitants of the South would not be able, like their northern countrymen, to initiate the slaves gradually into a state of freedom by abolishing slavery. They have no means of perceptibly diminishing the black population, and they would remain unsupported to repress its excesses, so that in the course of a few years, a great people of free Negroes would exist in the heart of a white nation of equal size. The same abuses of power which still maintain slavery would then become the source of the most alarming perils which the white population of the South might have to apprehend. At the present time, the descendants of the Europeans are the sole owners of the land, the absolute masters of all labor, and the only persons who are possessed of wealth, knowledge, and arms. The black is destitute of all these advantages, but he subsists without them because he is a slave. If he were free and obliged to provide for his own subsistence, would it be possible for him to remain without these things and to support life? Or would not the very instruments of the present superiority of the white, whilst slavery exists, expose him to a thousand dangers if it were abolished? As long as the Negro remains a slave, he may be kept in a condition not very far removed from that of the brutes. But with his liberty, he cannot but acquire a degree of instruction which will enable him to appreciate his misfortunes and to discern a remedy for them. Moreover, there exists a singular principle of relative justice which is very firmly implanted in the human heart. Men are much more forcibly struck by those inequalities which exist within the circle of the same class than those which may be remarked between different classes. It is more easy for them to admit slavery than to allow several millions of citizens to exist under a load of eternal infamy and hereditary wretchedness. In the North, the population of freed Negroes feels these hardships and resents these indignities, but its numbers and its powers are small, whilst in the South it would be numerous and strong. As soon as it is admitted that the whites and the emancipated blacks are placed upon the same territory in the situation of two alien communities, it will readily be understood that there are but two alternatives for the future. The Negroes and the whites must either wholly part or wholly mingle. I have already expressed the conviction which I entertain as to the latter event. Author's note: this opinion is sanctioned by authorities infinitely weightier than anything that I can say. Thus, for instance, it is stated in the Memoirs of Jefferson, as collected by Monsieur Conseil: nothing is more clearly written in the Book of Destiny than the emancipation of the blacks, and it is equally certain that the two races will never live in a state of equal freedom under the same government, so insurmountable are the barriers which nature, habit, and opinions have established between them. I do not imagine that the white and black races will ever live in any country upon an equal footing. But I believe the difficulty to be still greater in the United States than elsewhere. An isolated individual may surmount the prejudices of religion, of his country, or of his race, and if this individual is a king, he may effect surprising changes in society. But a whole people cannot rise, as it were, above itself. A despot who should subject the Americans and their former slaves to the same yoke might perhaps succeed in commingling their races. But as long as the American democracy remains at the head of affairs, no one will undertake so difficult a task. And it may be foreseen that the freer the white population of the United States becomes, the more isolated it will remain. Author's note: if the British West India planters had governed themselves, they would assuredly not have passed the Slave Emancipation Bill which the mother country has recently imposed upon them. I have previously observed that the mixed race is the true bond of union between the Europeans and the Indians. Just so the mulattoes are the true means of transition between the white and the Negro. So that wherever mulattoes abound, the intermixture of the two races is not impossible. In some parts of America, the European and the Negro races are so crossed by one another that it is rare to meet with a man who is entirely black or entirely white. When they are arrived at this point, the two races may really be said to be combined, or rather to have been absorbed in a third race, which is connected with both without being identical with either. Of all the Europeans, the English are those who have mixed least with the Negroes. More mulattoes are to be seen in the south of the Union than in the north, but still they are infinitely more scarce than in any other European colony. Mulattoes are by no means numerous in the United States. They have no force peculiar to themselves, and when quarrels originating in differences of color take place, they generally side with the whites. Just as the lackeys of the great in Europe assume the contemptuous airs of nobility to the lower orders. The pride of origin, which is natural to the English, is singularly augmented by the personal pride which democratic liberty fosters amongst the Americans. The white citizen of the United States is proud of his race and proud of himself. But if the whites and the Negroes do not intermingle in the north of the Union, how should they mix in the south? Can it be supposed for an instant that an American of the southern states, placed as he must forever be, between the white man with all his physical and moral superiority and the Negro, will ever think of preferring the latter? The Americans of the southern states have two powerful passions which will always keep them aloof. The first is the fear of being assimilated to the Negroes, their former slaves, and the second, the dread of sinking below the whites, their neighbors. If I were called upon to predict what will probably occur at some future time, I should say that the abolition of slavery in the South will, in the common course of things, increase the repugnance of the white population for the men of color. I found this opinion upon the analogous observation which I already had occasion to make in the North. I there remarked that the white inhabitants of the North avoid the Negroes with increasing care, in proportion as the legal barriers of separation are removed by the legislature. And why should not the same result take place in the South? In the North, the whites are deterred from intermingling with the blacks by the fear of an imaginary danger. In the South, where the danger would be real, I cannot imagine that the fear would be less general. If, on the other hand, to be admitted, and the fact is unquestionable, that the colored population perpetually accumulates in the extreme South, and that it increases more rapidly than that of the whites, and if, on the other hand, it be allowed that it is impossible to foresee a time at which the whites and the blacks will be so intermingled as to derive the same benefits from society, must it not be inferred that the blacks and the whites will, sooner or later, come to open strife in the southern states of the Union? But if it be asked what the issue of the struggle is likely to be, it will readily be understood that we are here left to form a very vague surmise of the truth. The human mind may succeed in tracing a wide circle, as it were, which includes the course of future events. But within that circle, a thousand various chances and circumstances may direct it in as many different ways. And in every picture of the future there is a dim spot which the eye of the understanding cannot penetrate. It appears, however, to be extremely probable that in the West Indian Islands the white race is destined to be subdued, and the black population to share the same fate upon the continent. In the West India Islands, the white planters are surrounded by an immense black population. On the continent, the blacks are placed between the ocean and an innumerable people, which already extends over them in a dense mass, from the icy confines of Canada to the frontiers of Virginia, and from the banks of the Missouri to the shores of the Atlantic. If the white citizens of North America remain united, it cannot be supposed that the Negroes will escape the destruction with which they are menaced. They must be subdued by want or by the sword. But the black population, which is accumulated along the coast of the Gulf of Mexico, has a chance of success if the American Union is dissolved when the struggle between the two races begins. If the federal tie were broken, The citizens of the South would be wrong to rely upon any lasting succor from their northern countrymen. The latter are well aware that the danger can never reach them, and unless they are constrained to march in the assistance of the South by a positive obligation, it may be foreseen that the sympathy of color will be insufficient to stimulate their exertions. Yet, at whatever period the strife may break out, the whites of the South, even if they are abandoned to their own resources, will enter the lists with an immense superiority of knowledge and of the means of warfare. But the blacks will have numerical strength and the energy of despair upon their side, and these are powerful resources to men who have taken up arms. The fate of the white population in the southern states will perhaps be similar to that of the Moors in Spain. After having occupied the land for centuries, it will perhaps be forced to retire to the country whence its ancestors came, and to abandon to the Negroes the possession of a territory which Providence seems to have more peculiarly destined for them, since they can subsist and labor in it more easily than the whites. The danger of a conflict between the white and the black inhabitants of the southern states of the Union, a danger which, however remote it may be, is inevitable, perpetually haunts the imagination of the Americans. The inhabitants of the North make it a common topic of conversation, although they have no direct injury to fear from the struggle. But they vainly endeavor to devise some means of obviating the misfortunes which they foresee. In the southern states, the subject is not discussed. The planter does not allude to the future in conversing with strangers. The citizen does not communicate his apprehensions to his friends. He seeks to conceal them from himself. But there is something more alarming in the tacit forebodings of the South than in the clamorous fears of the northern states. This all-pervading disquietude has given birth to an undertaking which is but little known, but which may have the effect of changing the fate of a portion of the human race. From apprehension of the dangers which I have just been describing, a certain number of American citizens have formed a society for the purpose of exporting to the coast of Guinea, at their own expense, such free Negroes as may be willing to escape from the oppression to which they are subject. In 1820, the society to which I allude formed a settlement in Africa, upon the 7th degree of north latitude, which bears the name of Liberia. The most recent intelligence informs us that 2,500 Negroes are collected there. They have introduced the democratic institutions of America into the country of their forefathers, and Liberia has a representative system of government, Negro jurymen, Negro magistrates, and Negro priests. Churches have been built, newspapers established, and, by a singular change in the vicissitudes of the world, white men are prohibited from sojourning within the settlement. Author's note: this last regulation was laid down by the founders of the settlement. They apprehended that a state of things might arise in Africa similar to that which exists on the frontiers of the United States, and that if the Negroes, like the Indians, were brought into collision with a people more enlightened than themselves, they would be destroyed before they could be civilized. This is indeed a strange caprice of fortune. 200 years have now elapsed since the inhabitants of Europe undertook to tear the Negro from his family and his home, in order to transport him to the shores of North America. At the present day, the European settlers are engaged in sending back the descendants of those very Negroes to the continent from which they were originally taken. And barbarous Africans have been brought into contact with civilization in the midst of bondage, and have become acquainted with free political institutions in slavery. Up to the present time, Africa has been closed against the arts and sciences of the whites, but the inventions of Europe will perhaps penetrate into those regions, now that they are introduced by Africans themselves. The settlement of Liberia is founded upon a lofty and most fruitful idea, but whatever may be its results with regard to the continent of Africa, it can afford no remedy to the New World. In 12 years, the Colonization Society has transported 2,500 Negroes to Africa. In the same span of time, about 700,000 blacks were born in the United States. If the colony of Liberia were so situated as to be able to receive thousands of new inhabitants every year, and if the Negroes were in a state to be sent thither with advantage, if the Union were to supply the society with annual subsidies, and to transport the Negroes to Africa in the vessels of the state, it would still be unable to counterpoise the natural increase of population amongst the blacks. Authors note, nor would these be the only difficulties attendant upon the undertaking. If the Union undertook to buy up the Negroes now in America in order to transport them to Africa, the price of slaves, increasing with their scarcity, would soon become enormous, and the states of the North would never consent to expend such great sums for a purpose which would procure such small advantages to themselves. If the Union took possession of the slaves in the Southern states by force, or at a rate determined by law, an insurmountable resistance would arise in that part of the country. Both alternatives are equally impossible. And as it could not remove as many men in a year as are born upon its territory within the same space of time, it would fail in suspending the growth of the evil which is daily increasing in the states. Authors note, in 1830, there were in the United States 2,010,327 slaves and 319,439 free blacks. In all, 2,329,766 Negroes, which formed about one-fifth of the total population of the United States at that time. The Negro race will never leave those shores of the American continent, to which it was brought by the passions and the vices of Europeans. And it will not disappear from the New World as long as it continues to exist. The inhabitants of the United States may retard the calamities which they apprehend, but they cannot now destroy their efficient cause. I am obliged to confess that I do not regard the abolition of slavery as a means of warding off the struggle of the two races in the United States. The Negroes may long remain slaves without complaining, but if they are once raised to the level of free men, they will soon revolt at being deprived of all their civil rights. And as they cannot become the equals of the whites, they will speedily declare themselves as enemies. In the North, everything contributed to facilitate the emancipation of the slaves, and slavery was abolished without placing the free Negroes in a position which could become formidable, since their number was too small for them ever to claim the exercise of their rights. But such is not the case in the South. The question of slavery was a question of commerce and manufacture for the slave owners in the North. For those of the South, it is a question of life and death. God forbid that I should seek to justify the principle of Negro slavery, as has been done by some American writers. But I only observe that all the countries which formerly adopted that execrable principle are not equally able to abandon it at the present time. When I contemplate the conditions of the South, I can only discover two alternatives which may be adopted by the white inhabitants of those states, namely, either to emancipate the Negroes and to intermingle with them, or, remaining isolated from them, to keep them in a state of slavery as long as possible. All intermediate measures seem to me likely to terminate, and that shortly, in the most horrible of civil wars, and perhaps in the extirpation of one or other of the two races. Such is the view which the Americans of the South take of the question, and they act consistently with it, as they are determined not to mingle with the Negroes, they refuse to emancipate them. Not that the inhabitants of the South regard slavery as necessary to the wealth of the planter, for on this point many of them agree with their northern countrymen in freely admitting that slavery is prejudicial to their interest. But they are convinced that, however prejudicial it may be, they hold the lives upon no other tenure. The instruction which is now diffused in the South has convinced the inhabitants that slavery is injurious to the slave owner, but it has also shown them, more clearly than before, that no means exist of getting rid of its bad consequences. Hence arises a singular contrast. The more the utility of slavery is contested, the more firmly it is established in the laws. And whilst the principle of servitude is gradually abolished in the North, that same self-principle gives rise to more and more rigorous consequences in the South. The legislation of the Southern states with regard to slaves presents at the present day such unparalleled atrocities as suffice to show how radically the laws of humanity have been perverted and to betray the desperate position of the community in which that legislation has been promulgated. The Americans of this portion of the Union have not indeed augmented the hardships of slavery. They have, on the contrary, bettered the physical condition of the slaves. The only means by which the ancients maintained slavery were fetters and death. The Americans of the south of the Union have discovered more intellectual securities for the duration of their power. They have employed their despotism and their violence against the human mind. In antiquity, precautions were taken to prevent the slave from breaking his chains. At the present day, measures are adopted to deprive him even of the desire of freedom. The ancients kept the bodies of their slaves in bondage, but they placed no restraint upon the mind and no check upon education. And they acted consistently with their established principle, since a natural termination of slavery then existed, and one day or other the slave might be set free and become the equal of his master. But the Americans of the South, who do not admit that the Negroes can ever be commingled with themselves, have forbidden them to be taught to read or to write, under severe penalties. And as they will not raise them to their own level, they sink them as nearly as possible to that of the brutes. The hope of liberty had always been allowed to the slave to cheer the hardships of his condition. But the Americans of the South are well aware that emancipation cannot but be dangerous when the freedman can never be assimilated to his former master. To give a man his freedom and leave him in wretchedness and ignominy is nothing less than to prepare a future chief for a revolt of the slaves. Moreover, it has long been remarked that the presence of a free Negro vaguely agitates the minds of his less fortunate brethren and conveys to them a dim notion of their rights. The Americans of the South have consequently taken measures to prevent slave owners from emancipating their slaves in most cases, not indeed by a positive prohibition, but by subjecting that step to various forms which it is difficult to comply with. I happened to meet with an old man in the South of the Union who had lived in illicit intercourse with one of his negresses, and had had several children by her who were born the slaves of their father. He had indeed frequently thought of bequeathing to them at least their liberty. But years had elapsed without his being able to surmount the legal obstacles to their emancipation, and in the mean, while his old age was come and he was about to die, he pictured to himself his sons dragged from market to market, and passing from the authority of a parent to the rod of the stranger, until these horrid anticipations worked his expiring imagination into frenzy. When I saw him, he was a prey to all the anguish of despair, and he made me feel how awful is the retribution of nature upon those who have broken her laws. These evils are unquestionably great, but they are the necessary and foreseen consequence of the very principle of modern slavery. When the Europeans chose their slaves from a race differing from their own, which many of them considered as inferior to the other races of mankind, and which they all repelled with horror from any notion of intimate connection, they must have believed that slavery would last forever. Since there is no intermediate state which can be durable between the excessive inequality produced by servitude and the complete equality which originates in independence, the Europeans did imperfectly feel this truth, but without acknowledging it even to themselves. Whenever they have had to do with Negroes, their conduct has either been dictated by their interest and their pride, or by their compassion. They first violated every right of humanity by their treatment of the Negro, and they afterwards informed him that those rights were precious and inviolable. They affected to open their ranks to the slaves, but the Negroes who attempted to penetrate into the community were driven back with scorn. And they have incautiously and involuntarily been led to admit of freedom instead of slavery, without having the courage to be wholly iniquitous or wholly just. If it be possible to anticipate a period at which the Americans of the South will mingle their blood with that of the Negroes, can they allow their slaves to become free without compromising their own security? And if they are obliged to keep that race in bondage in order to save their own families, may they not be excused for availing themselves of the means best adapted to that end? The events which are taking place in the southern states of the Union appear to me to be at once the most horrible and the most natural results of slavery. When I see the order of nature overthrown, and when I hear the cry of humanity in its vain struggle against the laws, my indignation does not light upon the men of our time who are the instruments of these outrages. But I reserve my execration for those who, after 1,000 years of freedom, brought back slavery into the world once more. Whatever may be the efforts of the Americans of the South to maintain slavery, they will not always succeed. Slavery, which is now confined to a single tract of the civilized earth, which is attacked by Christianity as unjust and by political economy as prejudicial, and which is now contrasted with democratic liberties and the information of our age, cannot survive. By the choice of the master or by the will of the slave, it will cease. And in either case, great calamities may be expected to ensue. If liberty be refused to the Negroes of the South, they will, in the end, seize it for themselves by force. If it be given, they will abuse it ere long. What are the chances in favor of the duration of the American Union, and what dangers threaten it? The maintenance of the existing institutions of the several states depends in some measure upon the maintenance of the Union itself. It is therefore important in the first instance to inquire into the probable fate of the Union. One point may indeed be assumed at once. If the present Confederation were dissolved, it appears to me to be incontestable that the states of which it is now composed would not return to their original isolated condition, but that several unions would then be formed in the place of one. It is not my intention to inquire into the principles upon which these new unions would probably be established, but merely to show what the causes are which may affect the dismemberment of the existing Confederation. With this object, I shall be obliged to retrace some of the steps which I have already taken and to revert to topics which I have before discussed. I am aware that the listener may accuse me of repetition, but the importance of the matter which still remains to be treated is my excuse. I had rather say too much than say too little to be thoroughly understood, and I prefer injuring the author to slighting the subject. The legislators who formed the Constitution of 1789 endeavored to confer a distinct and preponderating authority upon the federal power, but they were confined by the conditions of the task which they had undertaken to perform. They were not appointed to constitute the government of a single people, but to regulate the association of several states. And, whatever their inclinations might be, they could not but divide the exercise of sovereignty in the end. In order to understand the consequences of this division, it is necessary to make a short distinction between the affairs of the government. There are some objects which are national by their very nature, that is to say, which affect the nation as a body, and can only be entrusted to the man or the assembly of men who most completely represent the entire nation. Amongst these may be reckoned war and diplomacy. There are other objects which are provincial by their very nature, that is to say, which only affect certain localities, and which can only be properly treated in that locality. Such, for instance, is the budget of a municipality. Lastly, there are certain objects of a mixed nature, which are national inasmuch as they affect all the citizens who compose the nation, and which are provincial inasmuch as it is not necessary that the nation itself should provide for them all. Such are the rights which regulate the civil and political condition of the citizens. No society can exist without civil and political rights. These rights, therefore, interest all the citizens alike, but it is not always necessary to the existence and the prosperity of the nation that these rights should be uniform, nor, consequently, that they should be regulated by the central authority. There are, then, two distinct categories of objects which are submitted to the direction of the sovereign power, and these categories occur in all well-constituted communities, whatever the basis of the political constitution may otherwise be. Between these two extremes, the objects, which I have termed mixed, may be considered to lie. As these objects are neither exclusively national nor entirely provincial, they may be obtained by a national or by a provincial government, according to the agreement of the contracting parties, without in any way impairing the contract of association. The sovereign power is usually formed by the union of separate individuals, who compose a people, and individual powers or collective forces each representing a very small portion of the sovereign authority, are the sole elements which are subjected to the general government of their choice. In this case, the general government is more naturally called upon to regulate not only those affairs which are of essential national importance, but those which are of a more local interest. And the local governments are reduced to that small share of sovereign authority which is indispensable to their prosperity. But sometimes the sovereign authority is composed of pre-organized political bodies by virtue of circumstances anterior to their union. And in this case, the provincial governments assume the control, not only of those affairs which more peculiarly belong to their province, but of all, or of a part of the mixed affairs to which allusion has been made. For the confederate nations, which were independent sovereign states before their union, and which still represent a very considerable share of the sovereign power, have only consented to cede to the general government the exercise of those rights which are indispensable to the union. When the national government, independently of the prerogatives inherent in its nature, is invested with the right of regulating the affairs which relate partly to the general and partly to the local interests, it possesses a preponderating influence. Not only are its own rights extensive, but all the rights which it does not possess exist by its sufferance, and it may be apprehended that the provincial governments may be deprived of their natural and necessary prerogatives by its influence. When, on the other hand, the provincial governments are invested with the power of regulating those same affairs of mixed interest, an opposite tendency prevails in society. The preponderating force resides in the province, not in the nation, and it may be apprehended that the national government may in the end be stripped of the privileges which are necessary to its existence. Independent nations have therefore a natural tendency to centralization, and confederations to dismemberment. It now only remains for us to apply these general principles to the American Union. The several states were necessarily possessed of the right of regulating all exclusively provincial affairs. Moreover, these same states retained the rights of determining the civil and political competency of its citizens, or regulating the reciprocal relations of the members of the community, and of dispensing justice. Rights which are of a general nature, but which do not necessarily appertain to the national government. We have shown that the government of the Union is invested with the power of acting in the name of the whole nation in those cases in which the nation has to appear as a single and undivided power, as for instance in foreign relations and in offering a common resistance to a common enemy. In short, in conducting those affairs which I have styled exclusively national. In this division of the rights of sovereignty, the share of the Union seems at first to be more considerable than that of the states, but a more attentive investigation shows it to be less so. The undertakings of the government of the Union are more vast, but their influence is more rarely felt. Those of the provincial governments are comparatively small, but they are incessant, and they serve to keep alive the authority which they represent. The government of the Union watches the general interests of the country, but the general interests of a people have a very questionable influence upon individual happiness, whilst provincial interests produce a most immediate effect upon the welfare of the inhabitants. The Union secures the independence and the greatness of a nation, which do not immediately affect private citizens. But the several states maintain the liberty, regulate the rights, protect the fortune, and secure the life and the whole future prosperity of every citizen. Federal government is very far removed from its subjects, whilst the provincial governments are within the reach of them all, and are ready to attend to the smallest appeal. The central government has upon its side the passions of a few superior men who aspire to conduct it. But upon the side of the provincial governments are the interests of all those second-rate individuals who can only hope to obtain power within their own state, and who nevertheless exercise the largest share of authority over the people, because they are placed nearest to its level. The Americans have therefore much more to hope and to fear from the states than from the Union, and in conformity with the natural tendency of the human mind, they are more likely to attach themselves to the former than to the latter. In this respect, their habits and feelings harmonize with their interests. When a compact nation divides its sovereignty and adopts a confederate form of government, The traditions, the customs, and the manners of the people are for a long time at variance with their legislation. And the former tend to give a degree of influence to the central government, which the latter forbids. When a number of confederate states unite to form a single nation, the same causes operate in an opposite direction. I have no doubt that if France were to become a confederate republic like that of the United States, the government would at first display more energy than that of the Union. And if the Union were to alter its constitution to a monarchy like that of France, I think that the American government would be a long time in acquiring the force which now rules the latter nation. When the national existence of the Anglo-Americans began, their provincial existence was already of long standing. Necessary relations were established between the townships and the individual citizens of the same states, and they were accustomed to consider some objects as common to them all, and to conduct other affairs as exclusively relating to their own special interests. The Union is a vast body which presents no definite object to patriotic feeling. The forms and limits of the state are distinct and circumscribed. Since it represents a certain number of objects which are familiar to the citizens and beloved by all, it is identified with the very soil, with the right of property and the domestic affections, with the recollections of the past, the labors of the present, and the hopes of the future. Patriotism, then, which is frequently a mere extension of individual egotism, is still directed to the state and is not excited by the Union. Thus, the tendency of the interests, the habits, and the feelings of the people is to center political activity in the states in preference to the Union. It is easy to estimate the different forces of the two governments by remarking the manner in which they fulfill their respective functions. Whenever the government of a state has occasion to address an individual or an assembly of individuals, its language is clear and imperative. And such is also the tone of the federal government in its intercourse with individuals. But no sooner has it anything to do with a state than it begins to parley, to explain its motives and to justify its conduct, to argue, to advise, and in short, anything but to command. If doubts are raised as to the limits of the constitutional powers of each government, the provincial government prefers its claim with boldness and takes prompt and energetic steps to support it. In the mean, while the government of the Union reasons, it appeals to the interests, to the good sense, to the glory of the nation. It temporizes, it negotiates, and does not consent to act until it is reduced to the last extremity. At first sight, it might readily be imagined that it is the provincial government which is armed with the authority of the nation, and that Congress represents a single state. The federal government is therefore, notwithstanding the precautions of those who founded it, naturally so weak that it more peculiarly requires the free consent of the governed to enable it to subsist. It is easy to perceive that its object is to enable the states to realize with facility their determination of remaining united. And, as long as this preliminary condition exists, its authority is great, temperate, and effective. The Constitution fits the government to control individuals, and easily to surmount such obstacles as they would be inclined to offer. But it was by no means established with a view of the possible separation of one or more of the states from the Union. If the sovereignty of the Union were to engage in a struggle with that of the United States at the present day, its defeat may be confidently predicted. And it is not probable that such a struggle would be seriously undertaken. As often as a steady resistance is offered to the federal government, it will be found to yield. Experience has hitherto shown that whenever a state has demanded anything with perseverance and resolution, it has invariably succeeded, and that if a separate government has distinctly refused to act, it was left to do as it thought fit. Author's note: see the conduct of the northern states in the War of 1812. During that war, says Jefferson in a letter to General Lafayette, four of the eastern states were only attached to the Union, like so many inanimate bodies to living men. But even if the government of the Union had any strength inherent in itself, the physical situation of the country would render the exercise of that strength very difficult. Author's note: the profound peace of the Union affords no pretext for a standing army. And without a standing army, a government is not prepared to profit by a favorable opportunity to conquer resistance and take the sovereign power by surprise. The United States cover an immense territory. They are separated from each other by great distances, and the population is disseminated over the surface of a country which is still half a wilderness. If the Union were to undertake to enforce the allegiance of the Confederate States by military means, it would be in a position very analogous to that of England at the time of the War of Independence. However strong a government may be, it cannot easily escape from the consequences of a principle which it has once admitted as the foundation of its Constitution. The Union was formed by the voluntary agreement of the states, and, in uniting together, they have not forfeited their nationality, nor have they been reduced to the condition of one and the same people. If one of the states chose to withdraw its name from the contract, it would be difficult to disprove its right of doing so, and the federal government would have no means of maintaining its claims directly, either by force or by right. In order to enable the federal government easily to conquer the resistance which may be offered to it by any one of its subjects, it would be necessary that one or more of them should be specially interested in the existence of the Union, as has frequently been the case in the history of confederations. If it be supposed that amongst the states which are united by the federal tie, there are some which exclusively enjoy the principal advantages of union, or whose prosperity depends on the duration of that union, it is unquestionable that they will always be ready to support the central government in enforcing the obedience of the others. But the government would then be exerting a force not derived from itself, but from a principle contrary to its nature. States form confederations in order to derive equal advantages from their union. And in the case just alluded to, the federal government would derive its power from the unequal distribution of those benefits amongst the states. If one of the Confederate states have acquired a preponderance sufficiently great to enable it to take exclusive possession of the central authority, it will consider the other states as subject provinces, and it will cause its own supremacy to be respected under the borrowed name of the sovereignty of the Union. Great things may then be done in the name of the federal government, but in reality, that government will have ceased to exist. Author's note: thus, the province of Holland in the Republic of the Low Countries and the Emperor in the Germanic Confederation have sometimes put themselves in the place of the Union and have employed the federal authority to their own advantage. In both these cases, the power which acts in the name of the Confederation becomes stronger the more it abandons the natural state and the acknowledged principles of confederations. In America, the existing Union is advantageous to all the states, but it is not indispensable to any one of them. Several of them might break the federal tie without compromising the welfare of the others, although their own prosperity would be lessened. As the existence and the happiness of none of the states are wholly dependent on the present Constitution, they would none of them be disposed to make great personal sacrifices to maintain it. On the other hand, there is no state which seems hitherto to have its ambition much interested in the maintenance of the existing Union. They certainly do not all exercise the same influence in the federal councils, but no one of them can hope to domineer over the rest, or to treat them as its inferiors or as its subjects. It appears to me unquestionable that if any portion of the Union seriously desired to separate itself from the other states, they would not be able, nor indeed would they attempt, to prevent it, and that the present Union will only last as long as the states which compose it choose to continue members of the Confederation. If this point be admitted, the question becomes less difficult, and our object is not to inquire whether the states of the existing Union are capable of separating, but whether they will choose to remain united. Amongst the various reasons which tend to render the existing Union useful to the Americans, two principal causes are peculiarly evident to the observer. Although the Americans are, as it were, alone upon their continent, their commerce makes them the neighbors of all the nations with which they trade. Notwithstanding their apparent isolation, the Americans require a certain degree of strength, which they cannot retain otherwise than by remaining united to each other. If the states were to split, they would not only diminish the strength which they are now able to display towards foreign nations, but they would soon create foreign powers upon their own territory. A system of inland custom houses would then be established. The valleys would be divided by imaginary boundary lines. The courses of the rivers would be confined by territorial distinctions. And a multitude of hindrances would prevent the Americans from exploring the whole of that vast continent which Providence has allotted to them for a dominion. At present, they have no invasion to fear, and consequently no standing armies to maintain, no taxes to levy. If the Union were dissolved, all these burdensome measures might ere long be required. The Americans are then very powerfully interested in the maintenance of their Union. On the other hand, it is almost impossible to discover any sort of material interest which might at present tempt a portion of the Union to separate from the other states. When we cast our eyes upon the map of the United States, we perceive the chain of the Allegheny Mountains, running from the northeast to the southwest, and crossing nearly 1,000 miles of country. And we are led to imagine that the design of Providence was to raise between the valley of the Mississippi and the coast of the Atlantic Ocean one of those natural barriers which break the mutual intercourse of men and form the necessary limits of different states. But the average height of the Alleghenies does not exceed 2,500 feet. Their greatest elevation is not above 4,000 feet. Their rounded summits and the spacious valleys which they conceal within their passes are of easy access from several sides. Besides which, the principal rivers which fall into the Atlantic Ocean, the Hudson, the Susquehanna, and the Potomac, take their rise beyond the Alleghenies, in an open district which borders upon the valley of the Mississippi. These streams quit this tract of country, make their way through the barrier which would seem to turn them westward, and as they wind through the mountains, they open an easy and natural passage to man. No natural barrier exists in the regions which are now inhabited by the Anglo-Americans. The Alleghenies are so far from serving as a boundary to separate nations that they do not even serve as a frontier to the states. New York, Pennsylvania, and Virginia comprise them within their borders, and they extend as much to the west as to the east of the line. The territory now occupied by the 24 states of the Union and the three great districts which have not yet acquired the rank of states, although they already contain inhabitants, covers a surface of 1,002,600 square miles, which is about equal to 5 times the extent of France. Within these limits, the qualities of the soil, the temperature, and the produce of the country are extremely various. The vast extent of territory occupied by the Anglo-American republics has given rise to doubts as to the maintenance of their union. Here, a distinction must be made. Contrary interests sometimes arise in the different provinces of a vast empire, which often terminate in open dissensions. And the extent of the country is then most prejudicial to the power of the state. But if the inhabitants of these vast regions are not divided by contrary interests, the extent of the territory may be favorable to their prosperity. For the unity of the government promotes the interchange of the different productions of the soil and increases their value by facilitating their consumption. It is indeed easy to discover different interests in the different parts of the Union, but I am unacquainted with any which are hostile to each other. The southern states are almost exclusively agricultural. The northern states are more peculiarly commercial and manufacturing. The states of the West are at the same time agricultural and manufacturing. In the South, the crops consist of tobacco, of rice, of cotton, and of sugar. In the North and the West, of wheat and maize. These are different sources of wealth, but union is the means.